Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
ABC's 2020 did a feature on John Chambers called The Best Boss in America. Maybe that's not surprising in that he grew Cisco Systems from 400 employees to more than 70,000, more than 10,000 of whom became millionaires. And Cisco went from connecting 1,000 devices to the internet when Cisco was formed to more than 230 billion today. And he provides the infrastructure for the bulk of the world's internet traffic. He wrote in his new book, which is called Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World, quote, "We don't just make routers and switches. We're changing the way people work, live, play, and learn," end quote. Legendary Kleiner Perkins Chair John Doerr called that book, quote, "a must read on best practices for any manager." But get this. John Chambers has been advisor to Presidents Clinton and Bush, French President Macron, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Israeli President and Nobel Peace Prize winner Shimon Peres, and King Abdullah of Jordan. So it's not surprising that he was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Chambers now runs a company called JC2 that invests in what he believes are next big things, from stopping drones from terrorizing us to using crickets as a source of food protein. Would you believe on this show I will dare to sample them?
I'm looking forward to that, Marty.
I'll have them with you.
But this is not just some fly in the night thing. The New York Times recently touted it. But what can John Chambers teach not just leaders, but all of us, about wise working and wise living? With me in the studio is Chairman Emeritus of Cisco Systems and author of the just-published Connecting the Dots, John Chambers. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, it's going to be fun. I can tell already we're going to have a great give and take.
I know. Off the air, we were great. It really is a privilege, you know?
Okay. It's my honor, too.
All right, here we go. Now, whether it's a company or an individual that's had a downturn, your advice is germane in the book. You say you've got to assess how much of the problem is you and how much of the problem is external. Now, in terms of your own introspection, what would you say you've personally had to work on?
I think specifically, to answer your question, what I had to work on is at times, 2001 as an example, I became too dependent upon the data and felt that the data had all the answers. Hmm. And so when you grow a company from literally, as you said earlier, $70 million in sales to $47 billion, and you're growing at 65% a year, and your accuracy of the forecast is amazing because you're getting your data in real time at a time that other people were just getting their data on facts. And I was sure the data would tell me if there was a problem, and it did not. And in January of 2000, even though our stock was dropping, we were still growing at 70% the first week of January. By the third week, we were dropping minus 30. We never had negative growth ever. And so what I learned is it's important to trust your data and your analytics, if you will, but it's also to constantly test in the market to see something if you're missing. Lesson learned from me, the Great Recession of 2008 came. We called it in the summer of 2007. We said, there's something wrong with the financial markets. And everybody said, no. My numbers for the quarter were really good, above expectations. But I said, there's something wrong in the enterprise, especially financial markets. We could have a problem coming. And they said, no. Once again, this is Cisco, and you're going to be wrong. And sure enough, within 9 months, we were in the greatest recession. So I learned not just to trust my data, but to be able, when I got data, to go out and listen to the customers about what makes sense.
Everybody says listen to the customers, and everybody says they do. And in reality, most companies have the hubris to think, eh, maybe in the beginning we'll do a little bit of a market research, and then in the end, they don't talk to the customer very much. First of all, is my inference accurate about that?
Yeah, it is. I think there was only one Steve Jobs. Steve could invent things without getting customers involved, but it took him 7 years, and he was amazing. Almost everything I do, I can tell you which customer recommended it, which customer said to acquire one of the 180 companies we did. I can tell you which one said, John, your quality needs to be improved. I can tell which ones they created a problem, we helped them through together. So customer driven. But the data that you're giving is right. On the surveys I've seen, 80% of CEOs believe they deliver superior customer service through
right.
their channels.
Right.
Yet when you contact their customers, the consumers, less than 10% of the consumers believe it. So this is where you shouldn't believe your own marketing. And it's so important as a CEO, especially in today's world, to listen to all the feedback to your company, regardless of whether it's a very small company or very big.
Well, you know, there is so much of a tendency to BS, though, leaders, whether it's your own employees who, you know, we say we want to hear people who disagree with us, and if we got a big customer, we say we really want to hear, but most people like to be yesed to. How do you, what's the John Chase? You come from West Virginia, from a small, how do you get people to be really honest with you?
Well, I think it has to do, the leaders without realizing actually signal to their teams whether they want candid exchange. Very first time I met Jack Welch, and many of your viewers were not even listening or maybe even born when Jack was such a great leader in the 1970s.
He was on the show, so they were
I
here.
I know he was.
Yeah, okay.
But he would basically, in his session with his people, I went up to teach one of the classes at Crotonville for him, and he and his team were arguing like I had not seen anything like it. And boy, they went back and forth and back and forth, and finally they agreed and they moved forward. And I said, Jack, how do you do that? He said, that's the culture we have. And then I said, what's your biggest weakness? Watching to see how open he would be with his team. Mm-hmm. He said, my biggest weakness is when I see somebody really super smart and good communicator, I assume they can also be great in operations. Mm-hmm. And I let them go too long before I change them. I looked at his team and they all said, exactly. So I think leaders who are doing their jobs have to be secure in their jobs because it's a security issue. And you've got to realize the only way you stay ahead is to get market transitions right better than your counterparts. So the ability to listen and create what I call constructive friction, I actually like. But once we're through with the discussion, there is no passive-aggressive behavior. We move toward a common goal. And I think if you talk to people out of Cisco for the 25 years that I led the company, you would find that it was a family. We didn't always agree. In the end, I got to make the calls. But it was an ability to have that healthy give and take and move forward. And by the way, that give and take saves you. It isn't just a better way to run your company. It saves you.
I want you to get specific with me. Mm-hmm. Can you think of one example where some one of your employees or a customer said, John, you're full of it. You're dead wrong about this, and we should do it this way and why, and you actually changed as a result rather than fire the woman or man?
Yeah. Well, first, I've never raised my voice.
And I've heard that.
Now, by the way, that does not mean that I don't have extremely high expectations. I talked to six CEOs of startups today that I'm coaching, and the expectations were very high. But I believe that's not effective communications. Effective communications is you get the outcome that you want. And I don't believe in ruling by fear.
Right.
I believe in ruling by logic and trust. And in the end, I'll still make the call and say, here's where we need to go. But an example would be very early on, 1993, the first decision I make is I said, we're not building routers. We're building the internet, which will change the way you work, live, learn, and play. And we have to change our positioning to that. And even my marketing team didn't like that.
Really?
Didn't like it at all. And then I said, we can't be a router company. We've got to go buy a switching company. And as you read in the book, I got some resistance, especially on the company that I selected to go after. Yet those were two of the most fundamental moves that we've made. We referred to earlier the economic downturn in 2008. Not only did we call it ahead of time, and having got burned in 2001, remember I wrote down $2.5 billion in inventory in 2001. And that's a lot of money, even for one of the most valuable companies in the world, most profitable. 2008, I extended credit to the automotive companies. And several of my team, including my board, challenged me a little bit on that and said, John, did you not learn from 2001? I said, yes, I did. This time I saw it coming. This time my peers are pulling out of their financial support for the companies. And this time I'm going to do the reverse. I'm going to be a great partner to the automotive companies just like they've been a great partner to me. Fast forward, all the automotive companies made it through. Fast forward, I was the number one player in every one of the automotive companies. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes I get it wrong. in a flip camcorder. I love the concept. I liked it. But the minute I saw Steve Jobs outmaneuver us, I closed the business. And so when I get it wrong, fail fast is an important aspect. But know that any progress will have major setbacks along the way. Determine if it's a setback and your goal is still very much intact, or determine if it's a setback, you're not going to win and you got to go a different way.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, John Chambers. He is the chairman emeritus of Cisco, named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world because he has been an advisor to major presidents in trying to create an interconnected web infrastructure. His book is called Connecting the Dots. It's the subtitle is about lessons for leadership in a startup world, but I'm also focusing on the human being. First of all, I have to mention a little practical takeaway, dear listeners, that was mentioned in passing. You know, this was back in the 90s when they were talking about, you know, essentially the features. We're going to build these routers. We're going to build these pieces of hardware. Nobody gives a crap about that. They give a crap about the benefits, and that's basically the message, that we're here to help you communicate better, to learn better, to teach better, etc. Please, please, even if you're an engineer, focus on benefits, not features. Is that fair?
It is fair, but I'd take it a step further. If you look back during Jack Welch's era, we just talked about it, you could be a great leader if you were good on strategy and vision, if you could build teams and change the leaders within it, and if you could build a strong culture. You didn't have to be that great in communicating, especially to your customers, to the outside world, et cetera. In today's world, you've got to be very good in communicating, and that includes the engineers. If the engineers can't take complex architectures on drone technology or secure phones and say, here's how it applies in terms of its outcome, you're not going to be a successful leader. So I think it now requires all four of those, regardless of what position you are, a student about to graduate, a leader with 10 people, or CEO of a large company.
I want to push back on that.
Okay.
You know, in any work team, you know, you probably need one really good communicator to communicate up, manage upward and manage downward or to the public or whatever. But most of the work is done by people who are primarily going to be, let's just call them engineers, who don't, if we demand both in everybody, you're going to have a lot of jacks of all trades and masters of none. Shouldn't you be who you are? Like, I could never be, I can't fix anything. So if I try to be technical and verbal, I'm dead. Yep. I go with my strengths. I'm a communicator kind of guy. Is it really right that everybody has to have both the technological and the communicator, or really is there a place for both?
I think times have changed, Marty, and I love the give and take. And it was like you and I trying to work on a duck call here. We were going to have your listeners listen to my Maori duck call, but unfortunately the duck call didn't exactly work. It was broken. And I enjoyed playing with it in terms of the direction. But I think the days are over when you can only be a brilliant in one area and you've got to be good at communications. It doesn't matter if you're West Virginia University, which I believe in strongly, and Gordon Gee, the president there, is a great friend, and they're going to try to become a startup state.
He was Ohio State, wasn't he?
Ohio State and Brown University. And then we stole him back to West Virginia.
You said we. How did you get him to go from Ohio, which is more prestigious? Mm-hmm. How'd you get him to come to West Virginia?
Well, his home is West Virginia, and it's his last hurrah. And very much like you and I talked earlier, he wants to change the world one more time in his own balance. But it is the ability to, when you go to talk the best and brightest, and my wife, I'm so proud of her in many areas. She's a West Virginia girl, speech pathologist. She can't fix my accent, but everything else, she's been able to be an unbelievable balance for me in life. And she is chairman of the Lucille Packard Charitable Foundation here, and it's been part of her life for the last 10 years. But when you get the doctors out of Stanford presenting to the foundation and large audiences, these doctors are as wicked smart as you can imagine, yet all of them are taught how do you communicate. Because if you can't translate your ideas to how you work with an ecosystem, if you can't translate your ideas to how you get donors to buy into it, if you can't translate your ideas to say why should children believe in where you're going, then you're not going to play at the level. Does that mean that each one of us will be great in each category? You're right on that. The answer is no. Does that mean you can take a weakness, me with dyslexia, to where I could not read well? And absolutely, when I first started giving speeches, I'd memorize them, I'd lose my spot, I'd actually throw up in a bathroom before I'd go to give a speech. Mm-hmm. Could I, over time, learn how to balance my weaknesses with strengths that dyslexia has where I can picture the whole subject matter and talk about it differently? The answer is yes, you can. And then you've got to decide how hard you want to work on it.
John, many people have a disability. Yours was dyslexia. And there are two approaches, two very different philosophies about them. One says, you know, damn it, you really have to learn to read, so we're going to get you tutors that are going to really work on that and really get you to, and yeah, I know you had a tutor that you worked very hard with. But there are some people who say, you know, like you were saying, let's work on your strengths, let's minimize the reading that you need to do in life and focus on what you're naturally good at. At this point in time, having been a guy who had a disability, do you have a bias at this point, if you were starting over again, toward remediation on that dyslexia or skirting it?
You have to, I think, deal with your weaknesses. And that's true if you're an individual or if you're a large company or a government leader. You have to determine how serious those weaknesses are as far as being able to execute your job effectively on it. And my parents, who are my core foundation in life. My dad taught me vision and strategy 5, 10, 15 years out. My mom, a female doctor who broke all the gender barriers on lacrosse, playing lacrosse, and ballroom dancer, and a lifeguard, and valedictorian of almost every class she ever attended. They taught me how to strike the balance on that. But they were reading with me every night, and it wasn't working because they were grooving a stroke, like a bad duck call or a bad golf swing, that only got worse. And then the more I got worse with it, the tighter I got. And they realized it wasn't working. And they had the courage, because they're a huge believer that the equalizer in life for my parents was education. For me, it's the internet and education. And they found a spatial tutor who wouldn't grind it into me, but understood my strengths and limitations before dyslexia was even understood, and got me to first learn how to correct enough to be effective, and then got me really seeing that I could take a weakness and make it a strength. Once you do that in life, it's like a setback as a company. Jack Welch said, you'll never have a great company until you have almost life-threatening experience. Once you go through that dyslexia and you battle your way out of it, then you know that you can overcome things you didn't anticipate. Now, does that mean that I talk to people about being dyslexic? Absolutely not. I was scared to death of it. My hands even sweat right now, even talking about it. And it came out one day in Take Our Children to Work Day, and a young girl tried to ask in front of 500 of her peers and parents a question, and she couldn't get it out. And she started to cry, and I came off the stage and went down to talk with her. And she started back to her seat, and she said, I've got a learning disability. And I said, I do too. And I sat on the floor with her and talked through in a second about, here's how you handle it. You're not going to be able to read the question, which she'd written out in her hand and tried to read it, because you're going to get the letters transposed. And she said, that's right. And I said, here's how you do it. You picture what you want to do and then just communicate with me. Not memorizing speech, just ask the question. She asked the question, and I got up to go back to stage, to go back to the microphone. And I realized I'd left my lavalier mic on. And so even though I had no intention of ever sharing with people I was dyslexic, that's how it came out. What was interesting, instead of perhaps making me a weaker leader, I learned that people could connect with me more knowing that I'd overcome issues. And I got a whole bunch of emails at the end of that and people going up saying, first, value how candid you were. Secondly, you showed a side of us we hadn't seen. And third, I'm dyslexic too. And so I think leaders who try to have all the answers, that's usually what I find in my young team, and I try to coach them through, know what you know and know what you don't. And then for the areas you don't know, decide how important is it to learn, and then get people around you that help. And that's what I love about what I'm doing now, Marty. I get to coach 16 of the smartest young men and women imaginable in the world, because I get the pick of the litter. And then I also talk to another 40 or 50 different companies per month on startups just to help them grow.
You told me that one of the questions you get most often is, how do you deal with weak employees? You say you can get the best around you, et cetera. How do you, A, you know, people are, you know, I'm a career counselor. I've had 5,400 clients. And I know when people are desperate, the length they'll go to get a job. How do you, John Chambers, go about making your choice of who to hire? And if the person turns out to have been a mistake, what do you do?
Okay, so I'm going to deal with the second part of your question first, Marty, because that's really the one you're digging after. And we can take the first one right after this if you want to. It's one of the hardest things, because as a young manager, the first criticism I got at IBM as a first-line manager is, John, you're spending too much time with your low producers and not enough time with the ones who are really good. And your skills match the ones who are really good. You could generate a lot more business by spending much more time with the ones at the top. And I think that was fair in part, because they said, John, once you move on, your low producers aren't going to be successful, and the person behind you is going to have to fire them, and you're also viewed as not a strong manager. I'm somewhere between the two. I think very often, if you give people a chance and give them a idea on how they can change. They can develop and mature. So I believe in giving people a shot first. And then secondly, when it doesn't work out, stop criticizing the person and just say, this is nothing personal. It's just it's time for you to move on and for me to move on. So deal with them like you'd like to be dealt with yourself. I'm amazed at how many people, when they get ready to change somebody, they beat them up in the last meeting. Mm. And that's not any good for anybody.
This is exactly, you know, when Jack Welch was on this show, he had this nickname called Neutron Jack for being a guy who did get rid of his bottom 10 or 20% of people on a regular basis. And I said, how do you feel when they call you Neutron Jack? And he said, you know, I'm proud of it. He says, not everybody's meant to work at GE. He says, you know, the remaining coworkers feel much more pride if I get rid of the ones who are not strong. My customers get a better product. When I first came over to GE, at the Consumer Reports, our refrigerators were at the bottom. When I left, they were at the top. Our shareholders, our teachers, our social workers, they've made a lot of money thanks to my being, quote, Neutron Jack. So how do you react to what he just said?
Well, you can't argue with results. And that's where I'm a huge believer, and my parents taught me, deal with the world the way it is and deal with the facts and adjust to it. However, that doesn't mean you can't be successful with a different approach. And I've met very few people who wouldn't give us extremely high marks for how we did in Cisco and how we dealt with our setbacks. And we were a family. And we were not a professional sports team that you either, you know, you improve each year, you're out. I knew every illness of every employee that was life-threatening. Of their spouse, their children. I spent a lot of time on the phone on that. I'm not aware of another CEO in the world that's done that. And I did the same thing with my customers. And so I believe there's a middle level ground. And this is, Marty, what so many, especially young managers, miss. They get the vision and strategy as their job. They get building the teams their job. They are understanding more and more communications in a different way, especially in the social media world with speed of communication being used as a job. They miss the culture. You never have a strong company without a strong culture. You may like the culture at GE or at an Oracle or at a Cisco or a Microsoft or a Walmart or a JP Morgan Chase, or you may not. But you never have strong companies without a consistent culture. We were a family. Netflix would almost argue the other way. I mean, their leader, CEO, is really good, and it's a great company. But they are like a professional team. They expect you to improve. They expect you to carry your weight. And it is an up or out type of mentality. You can be comfortable with either one. You just have to be consistent as a leader, and people who join your company need to know what they're getting into.
Perhaps that's not surprising, then, that 2020 named you America's Best Boss.
Huh? Well, you, Marty, you get more credit when things go well than you deserve, and as we all know, you catch a little bit more heat when it doesn't go as well.
You keep talking about growth and growth in your workers and yourself. You talked about overcoming or dealing with your dyslexia. Right now, you're in your 60s. Mm-hmm. What are you working on now to improve yourself?
Oh, I am having the most fun I ever have in my life. And I started to pull away from the microphone because Marty pulled me back because I got so excited. My pupils are dilated. And the answer is I'm a grandparent both physically with two grandkids that I love, and they are the joy of our life, and my kids are the joy of the life. And I'm working with both my children in a different way, adult children who are both remarkably successful, and with my wife in a unique way. But what I'm doing now is I've got 16 companies that I'm the mentor, the coach, the strategic partner of the CEOs, and we're trying to create jobs at 40% growth per year on average across my whole portfolio. And by the way, I'm starting with jobs because I do believe startups are where all job creation is going to come. Large companies will actually decrease headcount. 40% of them are going to disappear, unfortunately, Marty. But even within those, the artificial intelligence digitization will destroy as many jobs as you hear. So if we don't get the startup engine running at a whole different level, it isn't going to work. So first, I'm doing what I love, which is coaching and teaching. And you and I think share that passion in terms of how much fun it can be. Secondly, I hold myself and I dream big. And I think you had the same thing. Shimon Peres, the late president of Israel, who was a good friend for 17 years, he always pushed me outside my comfort zone, always was wanting to learn. And I've learned how to do the same thing. When he came over to my house for a dinner one evening at the time that Israel was being rumored to potentially strike Iran because of their nuclear development, we had 7 SWAT teams from all over the U.S. and Israel all over my house and up in the woods and everything. And yet Shimon was the most relaxed person there. He wanted to talk to the startups. He taught us that evening, and within 5 minutes, we all had taken out notes out of our pocket and started taking notes. But he taught us to think like a teenager. He taught us to dream big. And then he turned to me and said, John, I understand you got an electric car. And I said, yes, Shimon, I do. And he always let me call him by his first name. And He's just been almost like a father to me in so many ways, and so generous with his time and his thought process. And he said, "I want to go see it and drive it." And I said, and then I switched over to the forum. I said, "Mr. President, your security team told me I cannot move you off the top three rooms here." And he said, "John, I'm the president." I said, "Okay, let's go." And as we started down, one of his staff came running up to me quickly. He says, "John, we are not prepared for this. But secondly, something you need to know, he hasn't had a license for 10 years. He cannot drive the car." I said, "This is going to be interesting." But he was so curious. And at that time, you're talking about late 80s, early 90s. And yet he was thinking like a teenager and dreaming big dreams. And you know, he has the same philosophy that I do, and I learned part of it from him. My regret isn't that I dream too big at Cisco and occasionally miss. I wish I'd dream bigger, and I wished I'd miss more. And he taught me that in so many unique ways.
I want to talk about creating a startup culture, because that's where the job is going to be created. And in fact, that is the name of the book. Who is the author of said book? Who is my guest? Fellow type A, John Chambers.
That is true. Both of us, endless energy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's correct. Chairman Emeritus of Cisco. Yeah. His book, Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World. Let's start micro and then we'll get macro.
Okay.
There are many people here who are listening to the show.
Yes.
Who are either in startups, contemplating startups or whatever. You are running a company that is, you are kind of supervising, if you will,
yes,
a portfolio of a bunch of companies that are startups. What do you want to tell our listeners about something that's not obvious about how to make a startup succeed?
Well, it starts with something, Marty, that is basic, but most people don't take time to analyze it. You've got to get a market in transition, business model-wise or healthcare-wise or government-wise, and combine it with a technology that's new in transition, big data, security, if you will, artificial intelligence.
Market that's in transition. Give me an example. What does that mean?
A company like a Walmart that is about to get Amazon. I was on the board of Walmart, and we saw it coming. Mm-hmm. And the Walton family is just brilliant, good people. And we saw Amazon coming, and we could not get out of the way. And it took them 21 years to have the same, pass the market cap of Walmart, the most valuable company in the world at that time. And it took, Tesla, 14 years to pass GM. And it took Uber 7 years to pass Tesla. The pace of change is changing with such tremendous speed. Those are technology-enabled market transitions in the automotive industry, in the area of retail. This is going to happen to every industry. So the first thing I say to a startup, doesn't matter if you're in West Virginia, Dubai, New Delhi, or Silicon Valley, is tell me what the transition is you're working on. Because if you haven't got a transition, you're probably not going to be successful.
Give me an example of a transition at one of your companies that you're excited about.
It's security. Here's a phone. Mm-hmm. It's the only, to the best of my knowledge, gets announced tomorrow. Mm. It's a safe case is the concept of from a company called Bravura. We had 17 people when I got introduced to them. Now they're over 50 people. But you basically slide your iPhone straight into this case, mm-hmm, and you close it, and nobody can tap in to your voice or tap into turning on your cameras, etc. And much of your audience, I know, might be millennials. They're going to say, "Well, that doesn't bother me." It will bother you when you can no longer take your smartphone to work because your employer, especially if you're in defense or in business, isn't going to allow devices that collect spyware so quickly and faces to it. So the inflection point is it's a transition on cybersecurity done through hardware and software. The second part that you've got in your hand is crickets. And this is one, Marty, that this one I tried to say no to so many times. And candidly, my curiosity and my weakness for dreaming big got the better of me. And we basically, we were at the Clinton Global Initiative. And remember, I'm a moderate Republican in terms of my position in endangered species here in California.
But you voted for Clinton, didn't you? Didn't you vote for Hillary Clinton?
Yes,
you wrote
I did
that
this last time.
I know you
first
didn't.
Time I'd voted for a Democrat for president. But I'm kind of in a tough spot because I believe strongly in strong defense and little regulation on business and strong education and choice and sexual orientation and immigration, especially high-skilled immigration. So as I look at this session, the Clinton Global Initiative, I had been asked to be on a panel with the person who won it 3 years before, and we judged 25,000 companies to the top five startups. Mm-hmm. The top one got $1 million, and it went down per one for helping the startup. The person that was beside me was the one who won it 3 years earlier with cricket farming. Mm. I thought, that's neat. Next issue. But I watched how he asked the questions, and then he said, "John, can I tell you about my company? My curiosity got the best of me. I said, you can tell me, but understand this isn't my sweet spot. Right. This is not where I invest, and I don't understand anything about crickets, and farming's nice, but don't know it. Long story short, as he got me to understand, it wasn't about cricket farming. It was about Internet of Things. It was about digitization. It was about growing crickets 50% faster. It was about saving the planet because you can develop a given amount of protein at 1/7 to 1/10 the environmental damage that we do with meat. And I'm a meat eater. And it's a cleaner protein but more effective for your kids than plant. And so it is the way to perhaps solve world hunger. And then Cezanne restaurant here in San Francisco, a Michelin 3-star. I didn't know what a Michelin 3-star was until they explained to me. It means it's one of the very best in the world. They did a 7-course cricket dinner for me. But you know what I did? I'm going to try to make crickets the next lobster, because lobsters used to be not to be allowed to serve to anybody except prisoners, and only prisoners could eat them 3 times a week. More than that was unfair punishment. So I believe that crickets will not only be the cleanest form of protein, but if done right, could be one of the most enjoyable. But the opportunity was just too big to say no to in terms of the challenge, because it makes no sense.
Okay, you
say now you've got to eat
lobster,
one there.
That's what I'm going to do. You know, and this, I am not one of these guys who goes on these, you know, reality TV shows and one's going to eat worms and stuff.
Yeah.
But I, you know, in the service of my dear listeners, I am opening the packet as we speak. Now, this is going to taste like chicken, right?
No, it's going to taste like a potato chip.
Like a potato chip. Okay.
And I think you've got my favorite, which is sour cream and onion. You can get them Texas barbecue, et cetera.
Sea salt and vinegar I got. You didn't give me your favorite. Damn you. How come not?
I don't know. Maybe I've left mine over here for me to eat.
Selfish guy. All right. Here, I'm going to do this.
Here, give me some, too. I've never asked my guest to do something I wouldn't do myself.
Okay, here we go. I'm doing it right now. I'm eating.
And these look like real live crickets, because they are.
They sure do.
They're already in format.
I'm three.
Form of protein you can get, it will make more difference, the protein you put on your plate, than what car you drive or how you heat and cool your house.
You know what it tastes like? A pepita. You know, a pumpkin, a roasted pumpkin seed? That's what it tastes like.
Well, at the 7-course meal, we did this with protein, cricket butter, cricket tea, cricket margaritas, and had a lot of fun doing it. But what you just showed, I think, your listeners is we've got to be willing to operate outside our comfort zone.
For sure.
And that's where most people make the mistake. If you only stay within your comfort zone, you're very likely to not achieve the goals that you want or your company goals. And in today's world, you're probably going to get disrupted. And the most successful people, to your earlier comment, are often the ones that are hardest to get to change. They think they have all the answers. And I know I don't, and I'm far from perfect, and I've made more mistakes. But the neat thing is, Marty, I've had a front row seat at the changes from mainframe computers, IBM, to mini computers, Deck and Wang, to the PCs, to Dells, to IBMs of the world, to the Internet, to the Ciscos of the world, now to a digital world. And not only as a front row seat, I was off in the middle of it, having done 180 acquisitions. And so for me, it is so much fun having watched this to say, how do you make a change? West Virginia got disrupted. I want to play a small role, hopefully with the university, on how we become a startup nation with the benefits to our employees and to citizens of it. And I want to do this across all 50 states, not just in Silicon Valley or New York and Texas, but across all the states. I'm already in 7 states. I'm already all over India, if you could imagine, with 1.3 billion people. And the French tech, global tech advisor to Emmanuel Macron, who's an amazing, amazing leader.
I have so much I want to ask you, but let's talk about, first of all, I'm just curious. You're from West Virginia, but not everybody feels the same filiality, the same closeness with their hometown. Why are you bullish on West Virginia? We think of, you know, us out here, of coal miners and yahoos and hillbilly elegy. Why do you believe in West Virginia?
Well, I think the first thing has to do with 4 generations of my family were educated in West Virginia. And this was an area where we'd been very successful. And we lost the chemical energy of the world. We had the FMCs, the DuPonts, the Carbides of the world. 6,000 of the best engineers in the world were in Charleston, West Virginia. And we had 125,000 coal miners. But all of that got automated. And it's the challenge. First, because we love the state. And I cannot explain it. All my grandkids and all of our kids, none of them have gone to West Virginia. All of them, every time we play football, they get their West Virginia jersey on, they care. It's a unique family culture. It's not perfect, but the people in West Virginia, if you talk to most of them, they have a real warm spot in their heart and for the state, and if there's a chance to help, they will do that. Secondly, it's like France. I thought in digitization it would be the UK or Germany would be the ones that would get transforming the whole country, changing GDP growth by 1 to 4 points per year, creating dramatic increase in employment, smart cities, etc. It was France. If you don't keep an open mind and you learn from others, I would have missed that, because when I talked to the leaders in the UK or to the leaders in Germany, they just were not going to move with the speed that was needed. They suffered because they felt they knew how to do it themselves. And yet Macron in France was willing to take the risk, and in 3 years they became the startup nation in Europe. 3 years.
Okay, I want to go all through this. This is really important. I want to have a little structure here in my brain, which is I want to talk about how to make startups succeed. We talked about one thing, being involved in a transition. So I want to tell me one more thing that listeners who are in startups or who would be in startups need to keep in mind that isn't obvious.
Okay. It goes back to you've got to do all four things: strategy and vision for your startup. It's all about talent. And I invest only where there's a world-class CEO in the making who wants to be coached and knows what they know and knows what they don't within it. I focus very much what the customers tell me. Do your customers really say they buy into your products? I ask where your lighthouse customers. I then say, what's your differentiation today and in the future? And if the answer is you haven't got much differentiation, the big guys or new startup are going to crush you. And so be realistic. Majority of startups will fail, and it's important for your listeners to know that, especially the parents
Absolutely.
Of kids who are
right,
doing the startup.
Exactly.
The most successful portfolios in Silicon Valley are the ones that take the most risk and have the highest failures. I don't want to have that many failures. It's too hard on me when one of my companies don't make it, when I see the young people just giving it everything they can.
Right.
So I'm going to try to get, if I do it really well, 2 out of 3 to be successful. And that would be a higher batting average than most. And I might sacrifice a little bit on the risk. I hope not, in terms of the approach. So what do you learn? You can have replicatable innovation processes, and that's what the book is about. You can have a process for how you do 180 acquisitions better than anyone else in the world in high tech. I think every high tech company in the world would say that's what Cisco does. You can say, how do you digitize a country with a replicatable process? You can say, how do you focus on outcomes, change the way the world works, lives, learns, and plays, as opposed to selling products?
Tell me about a specific, replicable process is abstract. I think when I think about that, I think of there's a book called The Checklist Manifesto about how to do surgery with checklists to make sure.
Yeah.
When I take my morning ritual is I've got a very clear, specific set of ritual things that I do to make sure everything gets done. Right.
Yeah.
All that. What, give me an example in the startup world about what a replicable process is.
Well, let me give you the example that I think the readers will understand how unique it is. At Cisco, we acquired 180 companies. Probably 2 out of 3 hit what we told our board would do in the first couple of years. We were like a machine. We were like the Borg. I mean, we just said we didn't acquire a company unless we had a similar strategy and vision. We didn't acquire a company with a different culture because I couldn't keep the people I acquired. They'd leave. My attrition rate on acquired companies was like 4%. The industry average is 20-something.
Absolutely.
We did it only if we could make it a win for both sides. I don't negotiate tough. I negotiate to how does my partner win, and then how do I win? And if I can't make it a win, I don't do it. And if they can't make it a win, I don't do it either. And so how do you do these differently? But case in point, I could get a call on a Thursday night about a $3 billion acquisition of a company that I knew nothing about from a friend on the NASDAQ that said, John, it's common knowledge. Your competitors are about to buy this company. It is a perfect company for you to acquire. And they've been in there 6 and 12 months. And I was embarrassed because I didn't know the name of the company. I felt better because I turned to my business development lead that night. He didn't know either. Mm. So I sent him over the next morning. He called me and after an hour, he said, John, come over. I met with the CEO. By lunch, we had a handshake for a $3 billion acquisition through both boards on the weekend, announced the employees on Monday, and no other company in the world could have done that. But it was that replicatable process that allows you to move with speed. I have the same thing for my startups. First is marketing transition and technology. Second is this real world-class CEO who wants to be coached? If they don't want to be coached, I don't fire them. I just don't spend the time. Then I go to what are their customers and what do the customers really say about them. Then I really work them on what's their sustainable differentiation. And then I begin to look at the quality of the team they build and who are their advisors and coaches, because startups today are going to stay private. I don't think it's necessarily good, but private for a longer period of time. So venture capitalists who used to be able to kickstart an engine and then turn it to public or get it sold are now realizing they need more operational experience to help these companies grow. And so that would be my real world advice on it. We did the same 10 plays on digitizing a country. Just the country leader, whether it's Prime Minister Modi or President Macron, they might say number one is GDP growth, number two is job creation, number three in India's case was digital manufacturing, number three in France's case was a startup.
Okay, so let's turn to France. You mentioned very much in passing something pretty important. We normally think of America as entrepreneurial and startup oriented, and you told me and you wrote in your book Connecting the Dots that France is way ahead of the United States in terms of, you called it the startup nation.
Yes.
What's the difference between France in encouraging startups versus the United States?
Okay. I'm going to answer the question very specifically, but I'm going to give you one takeaway before that I
cool.
think your listeners will get even more.
Good.
I saw Boston 128. MIT was an amazing school. They had the top venture capitalists.
128 is the road that goes up.
Is the interstate around Boston.
Right,
thank
right.
you. Mm-hmm. And there was 1,000 high-tech companies there, and they were big, powerful companies, the most powerful in the world at this time in high-tech. And we were the Silicon Valley of the world. Fast forward 25 years, it's non-existent today. They do financial tech and biotech, mm-hmm. but the IT industry is largely gone. If you miss a transition, you get left behind, and you get disrupted, and you're out of business. And this is where I think people don't understand. Given the speed that's about to occur here, this is why so many companies will get disrupted. What did France do? The reverse. France, instead of looking back and say, this is how we do it, they knew they had a track record of being the worst place to do business in Europe. But the citizens, especially the young people, you could sense the change. And they wanted a chance to participate on a scale. And so what you had was a country willing to move with young people, and actually the media got behind it. I thought the media would say this isn't doable. But when I said France would become the startup nation of Europe and it would be the innovation gateway, I said, how many even the media believe this? And I thought maybe 10% raised their hand. 80% of the media was already there.
Huh.
This was 2.5 years ago with Macron on stage together. And both of us looked at each other like, whoa. And so it is the ability to outline a vision to make it happen. You're about to ask something, Marty. Go ahead.
Of course. So if you were, let's say you were the czar of America, and you're the in charge of increasing entrepreneurship and therefore jobs and innovation, not just, you know, I kind of have a creepy feeling very often about fintech because it's often all just about moving money around in more concentrated positions, whereas if it's a product, you're going to enhance the quality of people's lives rather than just move money around. So if you were the czar of what I call ethical entrepreneurship, creating better products that are better for the world, that lead to good things, what would be your first edict as the startup czar of America?
Well, this is where we might disagree a little bit, Marty. I think if that comes from just one person or one person has responsibility for it, it's going to fail. I think this country has to decide, first, deal with the world the way it is. This is self-inflicted. We're no longer the innovation engine of the world, number 10, the Bloomberg Index, not even the top 10.
What do you mean it's self-inflicted?
We did it to ourselves with regulations. We were too slow to move. I'm probably the only person listening today that's caught frogs, cooked frogs, and eaten them. And when you put a frog into boiling water, it jumps out. When you put a frog into water that's slowly heating up, it doesn't jump out. That's what we've done to smart business and to entrepreneurs in this country. And we've had the overconfidence of saying we are a startup nation when, in fact, we're not. And even where we are a startup, it's lacking across the majority of our 50 states. So there isn't the inclusion on gender, there isn't inclusion on geography, there isn't an inclusion across many of America, and we need to change. So what would I do? I think we need to bring Republicans and Democrats together. This should be one of the few issues that Congress on both sides should say, we could address this together. You need the top of the support of the very top of the administration. They have to buy into it as well. You've got to deal with it. There's not one thing that you do that fixes it. You've got to say, number one, a vision of a startup nation, which includes digital nation. We've got to say, what are the 5 to 7 things that really have to move the needle? You're going to have to address some tough issues. You're going to have to address that our education system is truly broken and our young people do not have a chance to participate in an entrepreneurship type environment. That's very fixable, and other countries around the world are doing a better job. Excuse me. But the major thing you have to do is, here's the plan to get here. You outline the vision. You almost write the press release before you make the first move on the chess game. And then you regularly report, how do we do it? And you bring our nation together with both Democrats and Republicans saying, who doesn't want to create jobs for their kids? Why should this be a partisan issue? Let's get the regulation down, which is a real problem. Let's create an environment where startups have a chance to be successful. Let's deal with student debt, which is a real problem for Americans being so deep in debt about the time they would normally do a startup. They're saying, how do I get my kids through school? So I think there's probably 5 to 7 things that we could really go after aggressively. I hope both parties would do this together. I'm an inclusionary person, and I'm a believer that the only way you can do something this fundamental is for the majority of the people in the country to come together behind it.
One of the things you listed there and that you also emphasized in the book, and I've got a quote here from it, which says, quote, and the book, by the way, is John Chambers' Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World, but he also looks more broadly, including in education. He wrote, the K-12 education system in the U.S. is broken and in need of dramatic repairs, end quote. Well, the U.S. spends number one or number two per capita on education in the world, yet we score near the bottom among developed nations. So it's less of a money question than an allocation question. So now, if you are the U.S.'s education czar, what would be your first crowdsourced edict, you know, collaboratively inclusive edict.
Yeah, so if a czar comes in and does this, even a president tries to come in and do this, they'll get chewed up because of all the issues of an incumbent system that was designed for the past, not for the future. And I admire what our teachers have done in America, and I want to thank them for giving back. But we have to redo the whole curriculum system. We spend the most money, but we do the poorest job. Many of the textbooks I might have actually used or you might have used during school. And so we have to think about how do you teach entrepreneurship, how do you teach education, how do you teach technology in a way that's exciting, not just something the geeky guys over to the side do. You've got to outline a vision on it, and both parties need to come together. I think America's ready for this. And I also want to put a little bit of pressure on us. If France can do this, and if India can with 1.3 billion people, tell me why America, the innovation nation of the world, can't fix its education system and become a startup nation again.
Now, here, you know, I'm not as that sounds a little too pat for me,
okay,
for what it's worth. You mentioned in passing, we could teach entrepreneurship. Well, you know, the people who tend to go into teaching tend to be very anti-capitalist, very anti-corporate, and certainly have a business sense. And the professors who tend to create the K-12 curriculum also never met a liberal arts they didn't like. They like quadratic equations. They like Shakespeare. They like the Peloponnesian Wars. And the word entrepreneurship for them is almost a dirty word. Mm-hmm. How would you try to go about, I mean, that I do also believe that ethical entrepreneurship, you know, is ultimately not only a job creator, but it is what has enabled that iPhone that you're talking about and sure, even the crickets to solve the protein problem in developing nations. But how do you get this education system that is larded with people who think that entrepreneurship is pretty much a dirty word? What do you do about that?
Well, several things. And you've raised probably a question. We could talk about two areas just on the question. But taking them kind of in reverse order, you raised them. Number one, companies have to just do the right thing. And what Cisco did is we were always one of the best at giving back. We won every corporate social responsibility award there was, from the Clinton Secretary of State and President Obama to George Bush and Condi Rice.
And what would that look like? What would doing the right thing regarding education reform look like?
Well, we did one small segment. We educated 7 million people, about 1 million a year current run rate, on network academies where they could get a job for where the jobs are going to go in the future. But you need to get a small working group together that outline what do we want the outcome to be, and you've got to catch the diversity, and especially the young women, in the second, third, and fourth grade. By the time they get to high school and college, it's too late to get them interested in excitement. And you've got to do it with action figures where it makes this sizzly in terms of what you talk about. And then you've got to reward the states or the districts within the states that take the risk, et cetera, and you got to have courage. And the ideas are going to fail, some of them. And as a society, instead of the minute one fails, everybody jumps on and says, see, I told you it wouldn't work, become a startup nation. I expect a number of them to fail. Let's go for it. What's the downside? The worst thing you can do is do the right thing too long. We are in that case. We have nobody to blame but ourselves if 10 years from now we're not generating 25 to 30 million jobs a decade and another 20 million to displace the workers that are going to be the results of digitization, artificial intelligence. We know it's coming, yet nobody's stepping up the plan to how to do it. We've become too short-term focused.
I want to get back to some of them. I'm very sensitive to my listeners who are dealing with their day-to-day work life issues, and all this very high-minded macro talk may be seen as out of touch. So I want to get very specific for a moment.
Yep.
You said in your book that the Internet of Things is going to be a bigger deal than the Internet in terms of jobs and whatever. What should my listeners know about the future of jobs in the world of the Internet of Things?
They're going to be dramatically different than today.
Tell me more.
Let me be realistic. Yeah, in coal mining in West Virginia, even if it comes back and you find a way to do clean coal or something like that, they're going to be humanless mines. The equipment will operate. Drones will be all over the place. It's like an FAA flight zone in a pit or in an area. So you've got to see where will the jobs occur, and then you've got to train the workforce to get there. This is why I believe to do this, one of the things we would try in West Virginia, and if it works, I don't see why you can't do it in other states, is we're going to tie the startups to a university where the president of the university is willing to bet their credibility on can we become a startup type of skill sets in the university and get people to do it. You bring in people who are willing to bet their time and put money into it to be able to do it uniquely. So I think it requires a plan, and this might be a topic for the future on it so we don't keep it too high level, but it isn't complex.
I want to understand. We got to go back
Okay. Because
I think a lot of people may not even know what the Internet of Things is. I'll give you one little example, and then you're going to give a bunch of them where you think we should be excited. So, if I am transporting fresh fruit in a truck, having a remote control, a radio frequency controlled thing that lets me know remotely what the temperature is, that's an example of the Internet of Things.
It's a transaction, yes.
Right. Tell me what better listeners know. What are some exciting examples of what the Internet of Things is? What does it do? What are the benefits, not the features? What are the benefits that could be derived by people?
Well, the benefits is you're going to be able to raise a lot more crops on a lot less land with a lot less damage to the environment, that you're going to be able to know when a certain section of the field needs more water or more fertilizer. The farmer's going to know exactly what the market is like in a given area. You're going to use a satellite visual capabilities to say, here's where we need to send a drone to see what's possible on this. And so everybody wins. Your output per acre.
What about at home? In my home, how is my home 10 years from now going to be different because of the Internet of Things?
Well, one of the mistakes I've made, Marty, and I think you are a dreamer too, is I often anticipate a change before it gets here. Mm. We were doing demonstrations of a digital car 15 years ago at the Consumer Electronics Show
in Vegas.
Digital
car? What's a digital car?
It basically would be a self-driving car. It would automatically adjust to what entertainment you wanted. It would tell you if there's something to go wrong well before it had to occur, and it'd actually schedule the stop. It would tell you where the next gas stations are going to be. It would make an experience for your car, for your kids. It's just like their home, et cetera, on it. So the ability to see these changes has never been an area that I lacked on. It's the ability to break it down, as you said properly, what are the 3 to 5 things that you need to do well. Now, I also know, and we talked about this earlier, when I don't know an area as well or not as current on the issues, then I'll say to you, Marty, let me do my homework. Next time we're together, let me give you 5 really meaty examples on how to do it. But what it's going to do is connect 500 billion devices. Cisco started, there's only 1,000 devices connected to the Internet. It's going to know your blood pressure. It's going to know your health. It's going to know your DNA mix-up. It's going to cause you to live longer, much more healthy. It will often realize you're about to get a cancer before any symptoms show up. You're going to solve that. It will allow you to deal with learning disabilities like I had at a much younger age because they see the changes. They'll be able to see what works. And so I think it will change the world for the better, but it's going to have major weaknesses that we must address at the same time.
We're near the end of our time, but I want to turn back to you, the human being.
Okay.
When you knew you were going to leave Cisco at some point, and you created a succession plan, a glide path that was so successful that it was made into a Harvard case study.
Mm-hmm.
What was a not obvious but important component of your succession plan?
Well, the part that was not obvious is why did all the other high-tech succession plans fail? Smart people who care greatly about the company, their employees, and their customers. And so we tried to say, how do we do it differently? And we put a number of people into the pipeline. We then put them in competition. We did this very quietly. Mm. I knew I was going to leave Cisco 10 years before I did. Mm. And I said, instead of 5 more years, I'm going to be there 2 to 4.
And why? Why did you want to leave? You were young. You're still a young guy. Why did you want to leave?
It was time for me to turn it over to somebody else, and I was ready for my next chapter. You know, Marty, what your listeners may not recognize is I've never been to a graduation or going away party, except the last one at Cisco with 40,000 people at the 49ers stadium. I've always been on to my next chapter. I was ready to do something else, and it was time for somebody else to lead the company. And it's like your family. You want the company to be successful afterwards. So far, people would give us good marks on how that is occurs, but the real result is where is Cisco 5 and 10 years from now.
You wrote in your book Connecting the Dots, quote, "We need to redefine retirement to generate new opportunities for older workers." Do you have an innovative idea you'd like to try out here about how to redefine retirement?
Well, I think we've got to be able to go back to people of us that have a good deal of experience in life and time, you and me, and say, how do we help give you extra educational capabilities that will allow you to contribute back to society, make some money, and have some fun? Because before, retirement meant you're at 60 or 65 or 70, and you've probably got 5 years to live. Most likely, Marty, we're going to end up being 100. And do you want to be retired for 40 years of your life? And secondly, can you even economically afford it? So I think we've got to rethink how we use the people who have the experience. How do we retrain them, et cetera, on that?
Well, I certainly hope that you live to be 100. You've got a lot more good ideas left in you, and I hope I wish you all the best. It's been a real pleasure having you as a guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Marty, it's been a pleasure. Leave your listeners with one point of view.
Great.
Have the courage to dream, take the risk, and know that you occasionally fail. Get an innovative process.
John Chambers was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time Magazine, and he is the chairman emeritus of Cisco, and his brand new book is Connecting the Dots, Lessons for Leadership in a Startup World. Before I let you go, dear listeners, I have two little selfish announcements to make, but they're nice. They're little perks for you. I do a one-man show called Odd Man Out, which is all about my weirdnesses and lessons learned. I also do a lot of playing the piano, and it's a fundraiser. I'm doing it for free. It's a fundraiser for a local community theater in Orinda. I believe in community theater. And so you just Google Odd Man Out Nemco, and you'll find it. It's this Friday night. And it's a fundraiser for a very, very wonderful community theater. And second, I'm honored that Stanford University has named me to kick off their Distinguished Speaker Series on the 9th. That's this coming Tuesday. There is a limited number of seats for outsiders other than Stanford folks. If you will email me, I will let you know if there are seats available. My email address is mnemko@comcast.net. That's M-N-E-M-K-O at comcast.net. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and all of you for listening. Next show, next week, the show is preempted for a live presentation of Left, Right, and Center. But the following week, my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate thorny ethical work issues such as, what obligation does an employer have to retain a dying worker who is ineffective but wants to keep working? Plus, you can call in for a workover. Barbara and I will try to help you with your work problem. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archives of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 11 books, including his new one, Career for Dummies, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's MartyNemco.com. And join Marty again in 2 weeks on Thursday evening at 7 for Work with Marty Nemco, right here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.